Okay, let's go to Carol's question, which has to do with the next passage. But if he shall forsake my law, see where I'm there in 233. Mm-hmm. But if he shall forsake my law and walk not in my ways, and keep not my commandments aforesaid, the enemy, keyword, shall have advantage over him, and the son of iniquity shall have power to hurt him. But if he shall walk in my ways, then shall he not fear in the cold of the snow. And for all his household, there shall be covering, fine linen and purple. As we'll see later on 235, that word for household could also be translated servants. That comes up. If you go down about halfway in that last paragraph, the alchemists often speak of the assaults of the devil, which include haste, arrogance, avarice. Danger in our text is the cold of the snow. This might be a chemical reference to the premature cooling of the substances. As we have said, the danger in the corresponding psychological situation is that of inflation. You follow why that's such a danger? Because you can identify with this thing that you thought you were trying to serve, which is back to the current dilemma again, our modern personality type. In such cases, feeling relatedness to one's fellow men perishes and is replaced by an intellectual form of relationship. So there's one danger, that you identify with the self, and then you identify with the self, and you become cold. Now, a difficult passage. The reference to the enemy, see where I am? Mm-hmm. Therefore has a background of deep meaning. For if wisdom elevates the alchemist to the position of her son, then he becomes an incarnation of God. That's what we were talking about. But this Son of God is not like Christ, the benevolent Father God made flesh in a pure human vessel. This time God the Father incarnates in an ordinary human being begotten in sin, because man's own nature, vacillating between brightness and darkness, better corresponds to God's antinomy, and therefore makes a more complete incarnation possible. Let's look at that sentence for a minute. You understand the basic idea there? For the self to be accurately reflected in time and space, what the theological position that Christ is perfect does, it prohibits a full incarnation of the self, because the self isn't only perfect. So, again, I think here is the step forward theologically, that at the death of God, understood as we've been talking about it, for the first time, God really has a chance of being incarnated into time and space. Because the previous setup saw to it that only a certain aspect of that was incarnated into time and space, the light aspect. So, again, I think that's why, you know, Nietzsche, etc., is really a fantastic theologian and a fantastic prophet. And really, that nihilistic sounding message is showing us now we can really begin to take God seriously. But it's complex, because God is both positive and negative, light and dark, and we are both light and dark. So the danger of misuse of this experience is enormous. Chosen one must unite the opposites in himself, that is to say, his anima must serve as the birthplace of God's wholeness. Lest this task, or rather God's antinomy, should burst him asunder, he is warned to walk in the ways of divine wisdom. The only way you can avoid getting sucked up by the negative side of the self, which would be power, and in the Latin concupiscentia, unbridled desire. If you've read Hermann Hesse, that his novel Steppenwolf is about that. The seeker just ends up in this big party and burns up. So as soon as you try to serve God, the danger is always that you get infected and identified with the contents you're trying to serve. Does that help you at all?
So, I guess you didn't really talk about Sophia's role as the... She talks about Sophia as the mediator.
Yeah. She's the attitude that allows you to keep your eye on both sides.
And also, she is the divine mediator. In other words, outside of the human sphere.
Right.
So, this reminds me of what Jung says, where in Job, he asks God... Job asks God's help against God.
Well, yeah, so if he would be the helper against God.
Yeah.
Right.
The paradoxical idea that God destroys but has an aspect within him that counteracts his own darkness.
Right. And if you can see that destructiveness becomes creative.
In other words, you can engage it.
You can engage it, and it turns the destructive side of the self can, in the best sense, be your destruction of what is false. The problem is that often it doesn't distinguish. It just tries to destroy. It can also be your destruction of what is good. There at 234, the experience of the dark side of God could freeze all love. And the icy fear of God extinguish every vital impulse. That's one way that dark side of that God image can look. It's how Jung understood World War II, basically. Dark side of the God image broke into history. And the dark side of the God image is violent and cold.
Can you apply that to the current situation?
Yeah.
Competing aspects of the God image, fighting it out. The world's been
definitely. Okay, so far? More of the same, but not quite as difficult. 235, the mention of other servants. Or domestici. Who knows some Italian, don't you say? How do you pronounce that?
What is it?
Middle of 235. Domestici.
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 Current Latin.
Domestici. Domestici with garlic, please.
Yeah.
All his household. That's the phrase I pointed out to you when we read the passage. Maybe explained by the fact that the medals with respect to Gaul were often called servants of the king. Want to try to sum up that paragraph? The paragraph there explaining the servants.
So, is she referring to unconscious contents that are gathered around the concept of wisdom?
To a certain extent.
So that they form a whole?
Yeah. Question is, will they form a whole, or will you get pulled apart in their fragmentation? And if you walk in her ways, then your servants, your medals, your various components will be protected and work together, otherwise they'll fall apart. I think it depends if you're walking in the ways of wisdom. In other words, what this is just trying to lay out, that out of this experience, if you can remember, okay, don't lose your head here, follow where the dreams take you out of this experience. First of all, you'll be carrying a terrific load. You'll be pulled between positive and negative. And if you can succeed in not acting those out, but following the line, and understanding the meaning of the experience, and seeing a new piece of yourself be born out of the experience, you will be serving the experience, and then your inner servants will be working together. But if you don't, what could be a positive serving attitude breaks up into all sorts of contradictory, sabotaging, and self-defeating behaviors. Does that make sense? It's just fragmentation. And I you know what fragmentation looks like?
Mm-hmm. In dreams, I
think. In people's behavior. Well, I think in the vernacular, a very close approximation is sabotaging. You do one thing, and then you do something else that contradicts it. You know how many times somebody will meet somebody they really want to get close to, and then end up flirting with somebody else over here, which infuriates the partner they want to build a relationship with, and it blows up. And they can't understand why. See, that's fragmentation, when you're constantly working against yourself. There's one behavior wanting to pursue one goal, and then another behavior that works against it, and no recognition how you're thwarting your own progress. Addicts are classic for this. You know, I'm going to quit drinking, but, oh, I just happened to walk by my favorite bar. And it goes anywhere from the benign to the very serious. And you can almost say that is the opposite of individuation. Individuation is being one person, pursuing one direction, and not counteracting yourself. That's what she calls the disintegrative effect of evil. That's what I would call evil. And the disintegration is when the personality consistently does actions that are contradictory. And then when things don't work out, what do? Blame.
Well, what do you tell, I mean, this is, I mean, I'm trying to even relate that to my experience here as far as when you're going through storms and fire, discerning, you know, when you're on track as far as pregnating going off, I mean, you know, I mean, there's, so what is the solution if we, how do we know we're on track? And sometimes when you're in the fire, you're just in the fire,
yeah.
You feel good.
That's for sure. Well, this is where I think sitting still is important.
Yeah. And I'm doing that, I mean, this particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not fun, but, you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's why I didn't know it's the fragmenting. I feel that there's parts where you're going through that you are like.
Well, yeah, but see, it's the difference whether you're feeling fragmented or you're acting fragmentedly. That's a big difference. Yeah. And it's when you can't hold the fragmented feelings that they spill out over, spill over into behavior. Yeah. Right. That's where I think, you know, quiet, your own quiet, journaling, I think, is probably my mode, because then I can keep all my different feelings straight, and I don't feel I have to act on it. And then eventually a way does come, hopefully, through where you can act, and you don't feel that only part of you is acting. Yeah. It's so important. Okay, 236. Nothing new here, and he shall laugh in that day when I shall be satisfied, and my glory shall appear, for he hath looked well to my past. Same idea. And what she says there at the bottom of the page, kind of pick up halfway through the sentence, when consciousness actively participates and gives her due attention. That would be, you know, paying attention to all the dreams that come. And then following up on their meaning. Classic example in this Pali material, I don't know if Dave talks about it, but I'm working on another book on him, trying to translate it into English. And in the dream that the guy's talking about, Pali got very, very, very depressed. And now he'd done enough analytic work to know this is a vessel moment, right? So he sat with it for a couple of days, and he had this walloping dream. I won't spend our time on all the details, but basically it was about the nomination of a new professor at his university. which the person took as meaning that, that Pauli's way of teaching and what he was teaching should change. He should begin talking at the university about these sorts of issues. So that would be an example of a storm, strong emotions, and then what was behind that was a request from the self that he begin talking about some of these psychological matters and science in his work as a professor. But he didn't do it. You see, you could go through the first phase. He could stick through the depression. He could get the dream, but he couldn't translate that. He didn't have the courage to translate that dream into reality. So that would be not walking in her ways. Walking in her ways would be sitting in the depression, getting the dream, and then putting into reality what that dream asks for, and then that is the healing of the depression. Well, that's a tough question. It's I don't know if it's a complete answer, but a partial answer. He was persona identified. He always had to be a big shot. And he didn't want to suffer the humiliation of talking about these murky and unclear themes to the scientific community that looked to him as kind of a leader. He would have lost his authority. In a sense, you know. And it's still a problem. Okay, new image, 237. But not easy either. Therefore were the heavens opened above him. And there thundered the voice of him who holdeth the seven stars in his hand, which are the seven spirits sent forth into all the earth to preach and to bear witness. He that believeth and is well baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be consumed. The key image there is the seven stars in his hand. I think I passed this around. Do you remember looking at this picture? If not, have another. Everyone see that? Pass it around if you haven't seen it. So that's a reference to the Book of Revelation. And that picture is a picture of that passage in the Book of Revelations, where actually, let me have that back. I just want to read. I want to read you the passage, then you can pick up with where it says, because it's in here. I saw seven golden lampstands. This is John. And in the middle of them, one like the Son of Man. So that's Christ. And these are the seven lampstands. Dressed in a long robe and tied at the waist with a belt of gold. His head and hair were white. I need to read you this so you can get the full reference. His head and his hair were white with the whiteness of wool like snow. His eyes like a burning flame. His feet like burnished bronze when it had been refined in a furnace, and his voice like the sound of the ocean. In his right hand he was holding seven stars. Out of his mouth came a sharp sword, double-edged, and his face was like the sun shining with all its force. That's Revelation. I missed the picture. Let me read a little bit what Ezra says. The seven golden lampstands is one of the first things John sees. Zechariah, the Old Testament prophet, also had a vision of a lampstand with seven lights. And he was told by an angel the seven lights were the eyes of Yahweh. which reigns throughout the earth. So, in the book, now we have to put on our symbolic thinking hats, because this is, it's a chain of symbolic, a chain of symbolic links. The passage in Aurora refers to seven lights. The seven lights are a reference through the revelations background in Zechariah to the seven eyes of Yahweh. Does that make sense? Now, the question which is implicit in where she's going to go is this: why, in the middle of a discussion of Sophia, do we go back to Yahweh? It doesn't seem to quite fit. Well, it does by the time she's through with it. But we're dealing with feminine imagery. We're talking about a new paradigm. And then right in the middle of this talk, we get an image of the old paradigm. That's the point she wants us to consider. And so again, although that is supposed to be Christ in the book of Revelation, Christ is depicted with so many features of the Old Testament God as to make you scratch your head. And then that's the representation of God that Aurora picks up on. If you're interested, I won't go into it. But
isn't Sophia supposed to be the new?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
On the face of it. In the face of it. It will by the time she's done.
Right.
But we're talking about, see, Sophia, we're talking about the new king, and all of a sudden we get the old king.
The new king.
Yeah, and all of a sudden we get an image of the old king. What's going on?
Right?
Not transformed. This is the old king. The other reference, just to set the backdrop, she mentions there in footnote 97, in Daniel 7:9, remember how I described the God in the book of Revelations, the white and all that stuff? That's how God is described in Daniel, same way. And she's just showing that is really, in Revelation, it's a repeat of Yahweh, just confirming that, not only because of the seven eyes, but because of the way God is described in the Old Testament. Yahweh is described. And then that is referenced here. Now, why does this occur? It may sound like an intellectual curiosity, but it's actually quite important. Well, because the ego of Thomas is not yet in a position to understand this experience. It's not strong enough to carry this experience. And it's in danger of being overwhelmed by the experience and identifying with the self, which we talked about as the modern inflation. See, when this emotion is activated in a person with a weak ego, they just act it out. If it's a sexual energy, they go have sex. If it's a power energy, they go, if they're crude, they go beat somebody up. If they're more finessed, they devote their lives to getting a higher position. It's paralleled with the mythological story of Yahweh. Because Yahweh would be that ability to say yes and no based on right and wrong. So that's why it appears in this text. We're trying to get to a level where you say yes or no, not based on right or wrong, but on what the experience is asking you. But because he doesn't have that capacity, the psyche, so to speak, drops back. to the earlier form of right and wrong saying, which is Yahweh.
Because he wasn't strong enough.
Because he was not strong enough.
He regressed.
So this, you could say it's an image of regression, but it's a necessary regression. Because he can't handle what he's going through. Which, if I may say, is my frustration a little bit with goddess theology. Is the person strong enough to carry it? And when they are not strong enough to carry it, you see the value of patriarchal theology, because it's where the ability to control comes from. So one without the other is really dangerous. On one hand, I think it's fair to say that we're so patriarchalized that you want to balance. But still, if the ego, male or female, is dealing with the feminine, the question is, can they deal with it without succumbing to it? And here, he can't. So that's why you've got this reactionary image. And it goes a little bit to your question too, Carol, because God as judge, what the reason he comes in is because of the danger of that dark stuff that has popped up. But we're going to see throughout the whole text there's a problem, that he can't quite do it because of the weakness of the ego. And we're going to see that the experience comes and there's a fallback. Experience comes, there's a fallback.
Well, is this reflective of all of right now, or just kind of...
No, I think now we're in a position, now the ego has developed to a position of strength that it did not have, 700 years ago. Right. So it doesn't mean that the presentation, the experience is not valid for us. The experience in his unconscious just keeps churning out these images, which we'll try to understand. But we'll be looking at how the regressive imagery in the visions, which shows how he's having trouble dealing with it. And in a way, how genuine religious experience is often corrupted and co-opted to support the prevailing religious system that should be dying. See, he's going to try to shove it back in the old frame of right and wrong.
So, if he didn't, would he go crazy? If he didn't?
Well, of course, in his case, he's dying. So, I don't think there would have been any concrete effect. But in, let's say, a person who was, in their 30s, who had this vision at that time, it could very well have just turned into joining the power establishment, say, or, joining the split between love and sex that was so prevalent at this time. Split anima, which then the tradition of courtly love tried to heal. Let's see, this is a little bit before courtly love.
Well, actually, this is usually trying to kind of anchor back, right?
Right. Right.
That's not all that. I would think, there's probably many in the growth that would, there would be times where you need to do that.
I'd say it's absolutely typical.
Yeah, I would see it in my own.
Yeah.
I just pull back and...
I think that's one of the things you learn in learning this craft. You see people take a forward step and you go, oh, yippee. If you've done it for a few years, you don't go yippee. You think, okay, where's the devil going to come in now, There's a step forward and then there's a step back, step forward, step back, step forward, step back. And if you don't know there's going to be a step back, you can get blindsided by it. And there she says then on 238, throughout this whole passage, see there, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. But this whole passage, therefore, Aurora does not really depart from the Christian doctrine of redemption. Okay. Well, more on the regression now. We'll be following that. What happens? What does it look like when this thing starts to go wrong? And the sign of those who believe, 238, and are well baptized are these. When the king that is in heaven judgeth over them, they shall be whited with snow in Salmon. I have no idea what Salmon is. I looked everywhere. I have no idea. It must be a reference to a place, but it appears no place in the Bible that I could see in my concordance, or in Yom, or in anywhere else I could find. Anyway, if you ever find out, let me know. With the snow in Salmon, and shall be as the wings of a dove, covered with silver, and the hinder parts of her back with the paleness of gold. Now, this is also confusing because it's a chain of symbolic associations. Last words refer to Psalms 67, 14 to 15. If you sleep among the midst of lots, you shall be as the wings of a dove covered with silver. Now, first of all, Psalm 67 is a prayer of thanksgiving. So the lots there, as best I can figure it out, has to do with plenty. You know, if you're one of the lucky ones, if you have a plentiful harvest, you shall be as the wings of a dove. Now that sounds very nice until, with her eye, you start looking more closely at the symbolic precedent of the images. And you'll see it's a regression. The first tip-off is, which she doesn't mention, but just to start with common sense, ye shall be as the wings of a dove. See, it's plural, wings. And we're talking about the creation of a single individual. So that plurality hints at fragmentation. Well, she goes on from there. I'm just trying to get you started.
Well, you got me started, all right.
but the two images that we will be looking at are the lots and then the dove. And the lots, virtue of what we've been talking about, would refer to the overpowering nature of the experience. The apparent bountiful aspect of the experience, of the Sophia experience. The inrush of emotions, sexual or aggressive, basically, I've tried to define it as. Not limited to that, but including that. So that brings the lots, brings the text into connection with the Sophia experience. And Hugh of St. Victor, remember we talked about him earlier, interprets midst of the lots as a place between fear and desire. So we're not too far off in what I said. Between left and right. Now, the dove was generally interpreted as the multitude of the righteous in this passage. So, you know, the original idea of the passage is if you're one of the righteous ones, you'll be sleeping in a comfortable harvest. That's the meaning of the phrase, which then we've interpreted comfortable harvest, the lots, as the emotional overflow of the Sophia experience. And now the dove, the key word here is the multitude. She thus appears as an image of plurality in a place midway between the opposites. Now, how do people who are plural exist in the world? Exist in the world. If they're functioning, where do you find them? Yeah, this is the corporate personality. People who are corporate men and corporate women, when you take away the corporation, all you have is a plurality. They latch on to some external unity and give themselves to that to keep all these pieces from blowing them apart. Which, in a way, is for them an advance, but it produces a social structure that is lethal. And this is what Jung means by a collective personality. Somebody who does not attend to their own unity, and then seeks it by belonging to a powerful organization that gives them the feeling of unity. But the problem is that powerful organization takes on a life of its own. And this is the way people disown from responsibilities, because the corporation does it.
Right. Pardon? Be the church, people going in to, you know, send the, you know,
church should be one.
Yeah, the
I think the church is so is lost so much of its power.
Yeah.
But this sort of person. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'll agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. Because I don't see many of those folks. they tend not to. Yeah. I'm the devil and they're perfect, so why bother? But I do see a fair amount of corporate types. And it's always the same story, that you look at them and there is this polished, well-functioning individual, but they're just following a set pattern which is a substitute for bringing coherence into their own lives. So that is the... I try to put in ordinary language what this multitude looks like and how much of a problem it is today. It sounds like a benevolent, benign word, but there's that book, Organizational Man, which talks about the sort of bureaucratic personality and passing the buck and power positions and so on. And it's, as she's talking about, it takes its root in not following the path of unity or not taking the challenge of Sophia to try to bring yourself together. And I think it's the basis of right-wing institutions. Because then that's where that power comes from. It has to be there to keep those poor people functioning.
I have a question here.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, and I'm just kind of getting into, if we are truly all connected, is that still not a part of ourselves, the corporate? I mean, that's where I get, there's sometimes where there's so many distinct groups, and yet we're all connected, correct?
Yeah, I think the question is whether the connection is conscious or unconscious.
I agree.
And I don't think there are conscious groups. But I do think this text is trying to lay the groundwork for the kind of people who would make up a conscious group. And the distinction is that a conscious individual is one who looks to their own growth to provide them with a sense of unity, and then goes to the group to share with other people who are doing the same thing. Where the person who's not doing this goes to the group as a substitute for doing this. And then that corporate personality provides a feeling of being a personality. And then that's where and why our institutions are so destructive.
I don't think there's any group that thinks it's superior or another that's still destructive.
Is there a group that doesn't think it's superior? I mean, I think that's the very nature of a group.
It's sort of the nature of...
Yeah.
What's the difference, or is it between the people that just follow the herd? Maybe it isn't.
Same thing. Except, well, the only thing I think that these people are really powerfully following the herd.
Yeah.
And it's a powerful herd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it gives them more prestige.
Prestige. And these are people that if you look at them, I mean, fragmentation, you know, would show up a lot in addicts. And so when you look at them, you think, well, they're just losers, you know. But these people look successful. They really are fulfilling our idea of success. But our idea of success, I think, is skewed. And that you can see that this text is trying to give us another idea of what success is. Not being a multitude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about the person who is trying to follow their own individual path, who has to be or is in by means of their livelihood in one of those groups?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's possible.
It's painful. I mean,
I don't know if it's possible. I shouldn't probably sound like such a pessimist, but...
that's the way that we can move and grieve and be, you know what I mean? And maybe...
Yeah, well, I think that the sad truth is often then that organization attacks the one who's healthy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like in a family system, you know. Mm-hmm. The kid who is having the most trouble is generally the healthy one.
And I think the healthy one ultimately has to acquiesce or leave.
Yeah.
So that the system then gets no chance of being...
Mm-hmm. I mean, we might be painting too black a picture. There might be middle ground here, but whatever. I wouldn't want to say it's impossible, but it sure is difficult. And I think the basic theme is the multitude doesn't want an individual in there, and it will go after the individual and try to destroy them. And it's vicious. I was working with a guy who was head of a CEO of a CEO of a large not-for-profit, and he was trying to make positive changes. And interestingly, his secretary started dreaming of the corporation. He brought his secretary's dreams in. We worked on his secretary's dreams. And it was about being mobbed. And sure enough, he went and fired. And he was the healthy one in the organization, trying to bring it into responsible financial and community situation.
So Ben, is the only way one could change is by then, if one is pushed out, forming their own group of this other idea and pushing out the first group?
I don't know.
Instead of Baptists. Many different kinds of Baptists.
Yeah. Meaning that there is room in there for healthy cores, huh? Yeah.
Well, if you just look at it, if that's what you're seeing. I mean, if you're looking at your growth, you know, I mean, part of it, if that's the stage you need it, that's one thing is creating.
It's a very important question. What Chris, you know, obviously we're talking about Sophia here as an individual experience, but we have to live in a social world. What's the relationship? Well, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out how it works in the individual. There might be people who have experience, and I think, you know, this was started in California with Gregory Bateson, looking at how do institutions change. Back in the late 60s, I don't know where it's evolved from. And to be honest with you, the organizational consultants I've known, they're just helping the corporation be better at its games. They're not really interested in the health of the people in it. But there could be some organizational people around who could give us information about how groups change, which would enlighten us. I just am not aware of it. I really don't deal with it. But I think the key image here I wanted to leave you with is that multitude.
I guess it depends on that. I'm not involved in the corporate, but where we're at in the real estate, some of the conventions, they are opening up to a lot of like shadow work and dreaming more and more, you know what I mean, and bracers, which is really interesting.
In real estate, you're already mavericks.
Right.
Yeah. Let's say if you went to, what, AT&T or,
mm-hmm.
or Coca-Cola or...
Right.
Exxon,
yeah,
military, State Department. Well, that takes us to 238. I know it's tough going. Is it okay? It's so dense that it really forces us to concentrate. So next time we'll hopefully finish this chapter, because pretty soon she just starts summarizing. So, you know, what we've seen is the darkness, an attempt to deal with it, and then he flies away. We'll come back, it'll start over again. And then we'll watch that trying to happen time and time again. So how much did you read for today?
The end of the chapter.
The end of this chapter only?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think. So it's 238, suppose you read, you know, just to keep ahead a little bit, go to 251. To right before the quote. Thank you. See you in a couple weeks.